Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for attending today. I see a lot of new faces out there, which is always a good thing. Some new fresh ideas to the table. I want to thank Joe and thank all the members of the board who joined us here today. For the record, my name is Commissioner George Mattis, and I'm substituting today for Michael King, chairman of the State Workforce Board. Mr. King, unfortunately, did not join us today. He's asking to step in for us. It's wonderful to welcome a number of new members to the board and welcome some familiar faces back to the board as well. Jim and Kate and I thank you for stepping up and serving on the support board. Some quick notes as we begin the meeting. This meeting is being recorded. Before speaking, please state your name so that the transcription service can accurately document today's meeting. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the board. It's open to the public and will be run in a manner compliant with an RSA 91-A. The meeting material for the board and the public can be found by visiting the NH Works webpage, www.nhworks.org. We've got a number of items to work through today. You will find these items on the agenda with a close set of documents. The agenda and these documents have been provided to the board electronically last week. Printed copies are available today, and all materials are available to the public on the NH Works website. With that, Joe, we can get to W.
Thank you, Commissioner. And for the record, Jim Dorian. We're going to take a roll call attendance by last name. Mike Albers.
Here.
Thank you. Jim Alden.
Here.
Thank you. And if I'm also welcoming a number of new board members, if I do say your last name or name wrong, please let me know after the record. Joseph Alexander.
Here.
Thank you. Kevin Abard. Rick Bardo.
Here.
Thank you. Christine Brennan. Joe Brown. Anya Brzezinski. Kelly Clark.
Here.
Thank you. Kenneth Clinton.
Here.
Thank you. George Pavis.
Here, President.
Thank you. Bruce Crozier. Mary Crowley.
Here.
Thank you. Tyler Eaton. Patrick Fall.
Here.
Thank you. George Hansel.
Here.
Thank you. John Hennessy. Mr. Hennessy will be late, Mr. Chairman. He let us know ahead of time. Michael Kane is absent. Justin Cantor.
Here.
Thank you. Tina Kasem. Tamer Cokeel.
Here.
Thank you. Shane Long.
Here.
Thank you. Donnelly Lozo.
Here.
Thank you. Lorianne Lundgren. Larry Major. Jonathan Melanson.
Here.
Thank you. Ashok Patel. Jim Crew. Shannon Reed.
Here.
Thank you. Tim Singh.
Here.
Thank you. Gary Thomas.
Here.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, with the roll call, can I give you a form?
Right. Thank you, Joe. The next item is the meeting minutes. The meeting minutes are on October 19th are found in your packet. If there are no errors, corrections, or omissions, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes. So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Again, I'd like to welcome you today. And my name is Mr. George Mattis from the Commission Department of Employment Security. Appreciate you being with us today. And we've got a lot of items to attend to, so we've got a full agenda and a lot of information to cover, so I'm going to get started. Public comment. We'd like to take a moment to see if there's anyone from the public that would like to provide any public comment. Okay, informational items for the record. Again, this is Commissioner George Mattis. We'll start our agenda today with some informational items. These are reports and updates provided to the board. These do not require a vote. However, if the board members would like to make a motion, we ask you to please wait until the next section on our agenda. Please remember, before speaking, please state your name for the recording. Joe, please guide us through the steps.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we have the informational items you see in Section 2. We're honored to have former Judge Broderick here with us. But before we welcome former Justice Broderick up, we have something that's not on the agenda, something that is very new. Part of what we're trying to do is to transform the board, to thank thank the board members for their service. We're joined today with by David Chopping, who was a longtime board member. David stepped off the board, and we have a small award and presentation we'd like to present to Dave. He took a trip down to the Upper Valley on this beautiful day. Dave joined the board under former Governor Craig Henson and has served for a number of years on the board. Dave has been an incredibly active board member, having read, I think, thousands of pages of RFP and policy documents that we've put before. Don't worry, you won't have to read thousands and thousands of pages unless you want to. But Dave, whenever we needed a volunteer, Dave always stepped up. He was always so helpful, providing great feedback, not only between board meetings, but here at the board meeting. We want to thank Dave and create an award, the David M. Chopping Award, which will be presented annually to a board member, thanking them for their exceptional service. So we'd like to present the first annual David M. Chopping Award to David Chopping for his many years of service.
I just like to thank everybody. It's always been fun coming down, meeting everybody, and the staff, of course. Whenever we have questions, we can email the staff to answer them. It's been an incredible ride. You all will enjoy it. I remember when I started a while ago, Dick Manning was the chair, and I remember him telling us that, look, New Hampshire is one of the only two states in the USA without a job corps. We need to do something about it. And he did something about it. He'd come to a meeting and say, well, the planning board approved a job corps. And the utilities are up. Foundation is up. Pretty soon the buildings are up. And suddenly we had a job corps. And the best part of it is Tamer came along to run the job corps. And I encourage every one of you to go down and visit the job corps in Manchester and see what a crown jewel it is. And we really are fortunate to have it, and to have the workforce board and all of you people who volunteer your time. So I encourage you to get active. Don't just come to the meetings, but do things like Kelly Clark. She's always on board with something. And that's about all. The only other thing, Joe, was I was hoping he would have given me some sack buckets. Some of mine are getting rusty. Thank you.
Dave, I just wanted to send my sincerest congratulations to you all you've done over the years. When I started way back then,
yes,
2004,
yeah.
And you've always brought significant ideas to the table. You were always fully engaged with the process, and you did your due diligence on everything that we had that came before the board. So I just want to thank you for your commitment. I hope you've been doing the gym lately, because that piece is fairly heavy, and it's going to take a little bit for you to carry that baby home.
So well, I've been playing lots of golf, so I've done good to handle it.
Thank you so much, Dave.
All right, thank you.
And then thank you for indulging us, and we look forward to presenting to you, to a member of the board next year, the second David M. Chopping Award. So we'd like to welcome former Chief Justice John Broderick for a presentation on mental health, followed by a conversation about how we can try to implement some best practices into the workforce system here in New Hampshire. Again, we're trying to provide opportunities for the board to hear from experts in the field about what's going on, but then to tie it back into more high-level discussions after. We would like to thank Justice Broderick for being here and welcome him up.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Can you all hear me?
Yes,
yes you can. I want to thank the commissioner for inviting me here today. He told me I should not go longer than 3 hours. I promise I won't do that. I'm also here with Paula Booth, who will speak for a few minutes. She's the head of the Employee Assistance Program for the state of New York. And my remarks today, I'm going to try to tailor it to why you're here and what you're doing on this commission. But let me start by saying that for the last 6 years of my life, I've been traveling and speaking wherever I'm invited. Because of Dr. Thitcock, I'm able to do it. Trying to change the culture of the conversation around mental health in the United States, not because I'm smart, but because I was pretty ignorant. I'm not ignorant now. Well, over the last 6 years, I've traveled by car 95,000 miles. I'm on my second Jeep, by the way. I've traveled all over New England. I've spoken at almost 300 middle schools and high schools to 100,000 kids, grades 6 through 12. Probably 40,000 adults beyond that. I have no right to understand this generation, but I feel like I'm part of it. I love these kids. And I feel a fiduciary duty after 6 years of travel and talks and hugging thousands of kids with wet eyes to use my voice for them. That's why I'm here today. I'm a baby boomer, now that you could attest that. Increasingly, I'm the oldest person in every room I have. That's pretty disquieting for me, but it's true. And in the world I grew up in, no one talked about mental health, no one talked about it, just was too awkward. So we just let the conversation pass. We all kind of knew somebody, but nobody wanted to identify that. And I didn't understand mental illness at all. You know, growing up in forestry, it didn't exist in my town, by the way. 20,000 people. Every marriage in my town was happy, too. That's the world I'm from. And so I didn't see it or understand it until it entered my own house. I had two sons, 11 and 13, that took up residence in my 13-year-old son. Smart, decent, funny, athletic. My wife and I are baby boomers. We didn't see it for what it was, and we didn't appreciate it for what it was. It makes sense. How would you know if you had a mental health problem? Just how you feel, how you react to other people. But he was suffering. He thought it was just him. And it wasn't just him, but we didn't see that. In the years to follow, my son got a bachelor's degree, got a master's degree. He's a really accomplished artist. He's a really decent person. When we saw his problems, they were alcohol. That's what we saw. And we reached out to the alcohol experts, and they confirmed that he was an alcoholic. He denied it, of course. Eventually, we went to Al-Anon meetings, my wife and I, to deal with my son's alcoholism. He thought that was crazy. He said, "Dad, I'm not an alcoholic. If I didn't have these feelings, I wouldn't be drinking." I told lots of the alcohol people that didn't change their mind, by the way. Judge, every alcoholic has a reason to drink. Your son's an alcoholic. At some point, he said, "You're going to have a decision to make, and here it is. You can either put your son out, literally out of your house, hope he hits bottom and turns his life around." I remember that expression somewhere in my childhood. "Or you can let him stay in your house, and he's going to die drinking in your house, not tomorrow, next year. But you can't drink like he's drinking and have a lot of luck." we persuaded my son to go to alcohol rehab. And it was like the world tour of alcohol rehab. New Hampshire, Connecticut, Cape Cod, and finally he went to Florida. And we were praying, we had an insight about his drinking. And I picked him up at the airport weeks later. He said, "Dad, I had a drink on the plane on the way home, but I don't have a drink anymore." Finally, my wife and I had to make that decision. They told us we had to make. We loved our son, as you can imagine. We didn't want to die drinking. I was on the Supreme Court at the time, and we finally said, "There really is no choice. We need to put it out." It was the hardest decision we ever made. It was the worst decision we ever could have made. I regret it deeply. He lived on the street for a while, slept in his car, ate at the soup kitchen when he was eating, slept at the shelter. Eventually, we brought him home. We didn't want that phone call that no parent wants. And once he came home, he was drinking as much as he had been before. It's kind of hide it, trying to conceal it, but he couldn't. And looking back, I think he was probably scared to death that we were going to put him out again, and he knew he couldn't go out again. So one night, when he was drinking, he assaulted me. I went to the intensive care unit at the LA hospital. I was in the ICU for 6 or 8 days. I have no memory of that, but my wife did. My master's educated, funny, talented, decent son was arraigned in a public courtroom before a lot of press. I was on the Supreme Court as a student. And he went to the Valley Street Jail. I don't know how my wife endured that time. I don't know how my son endured that time. It was all over the news here in Massachusetts. They wrote about it in the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times. My doctors went on the Today Show when I was in the ICU to talk about how I was doing. The Attorney General once said he had a lot of press conferences to talk about. But I wasn't exactly with the program, so I didn't know any of that was happening. But my wife did. She visited my son at Valley Street when I was in the hospital, said he had a jumpsuit on, orange. His legs were shackled. They talked by phone, plexiglass between them. And he was really upset. She said, "I can't believe I did that to Dad. Just tell me mommy's going to be okay. And I'll forgive myself." In the early days, she didn't know. She would visit him twice a week, and on days when she couldn't, they would agree that she'd go to the street corner by the cemetery. You can see that from his cell, he said. "So, Mom, I know my family didn't abandon me if I saw you." My wife would drive there by herself, late March, early April, kind of dreary. She said, "I'd walk to the street corner at the appointed hour, and I'd wave at the jail." Yeah, I didn't know what floor, what window, or even if he was looking back, but he cried all the way. It was all very public. I don't know how she endured it, to be honest. After 6 or 8 days, they brought me to a top floor room at the Elliott. And by the way, when you visit people in the hospital, try not to say, "I love you, Lord." Don't say that. You used to say to me, "I love hate my Lord." So I tried not to say that. But as they were pushing me down the hallway, I said to the guy who was pushing me, "What am I doing here?" He said, "I think you fell, Jake." I had no memory of that, but I had no memory of anything else, so I accepted it. After about a day and a half in that room, my wife and I were finally alone. No doctors, no nurses, no one. And she told me, as best she knew, what had happened, that I hadn't fallen. And she told me where my son was. And we just cried. I'd been a judge of the Lord my whole life at that point, so I knew what it meant for him, for us, even for his brother. I don't know the dictionary definition of hopelessness, but I know what it feels like. That's exactly what it feels like. I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't go home with my wife. I couldn't call my son. I love nurses, by the way. I love nurses. wasn't sleeping well. I was a nurse that was there from the 11 to 7 trip. She came in some nights at 2 a.m., sit by the side of my bed, hold my right hand, and talk to me. I said to her one night, "Isn't there something more important you should be doing?" She said, "I think this is pretty important." I love nurses. They're the care and health care. I didn't see my son for 6 months. The court wouldn't allow me to visit the jail. I didn't see him until he came to a widow's basement, Brooklyn in Manchester, to be sentenced to the state prison. Hope you don't have that day anymore. I would have been anything I did or home or might ever do wrong. That could never be my family. It was on that day. My son came in through a side entrance with a veil for a cell phone. My wife and I were in the first public row, and I stood up. He looked great, by the way. I'd had a drink in 6 months. He was wearing civilian clothing, and I wouldn't see that for years. And he walked over to me, gave me a big hug, and hugged my wife, and held me back, said, "Dad, are you okay? I'm so sorry. I don't know why I did that to you. Just tell me you're going to be okay." I said, "Well, tell me I'm going to be fine, but..." I said it that morning, "If you don't quit, your mother and I won't quit." I'm not sure I believe that, but that's what I told him. He said, "I won't quit, then." Then my master's educated, decent, funny, talented son was sentenced to 7.5 to 15 years in the state prison. I don't know how we all didn't pass out. The court suspended 4 of the 7.5. He served 6 already at Valley Street. So he was going to jail for 3 to 15 years, and then he was gone. And after 30 days, they allowed new inmates to have visitors. They evaluated every new inmate, what their issues were, should they live on this campus. I wish I didn't know that factory, but I do. Anyway, we finally went up and met with the head psychiatrist, 2 social workers, my son who had to approve it, and my wife and I. The psychiatrist, Dr. Knowles, started the meeting out by saying, "I've come to know your son since he's been here. I really like him. He's really smart." He said, "He's funny. He's handsome." He said, "He's got every nice thing you need to be successful." And I said to him that morning, "I know we love our son, but we're in prison together." He said, "I know that too. Let me tell you what's going on." Said, "Your son has really serious depression. He has anxiety and panic attacks, the feeling you're about to die." He said, "Those are off the charts for him." He was drinking drugs, which that was the only relief he could find. He was self-medicating, it's kind of a health problem. And he said that to us in that place. I knew we had failed him. We were, after all, the parents. I should have known something about mental health. I didn't. I thought all mental health problems, by the way, were basically hopeless. If you had them, you had them, and good luck. That's so far from true. I know treatment worked. But I didn't know that one. After about 4 months, we visited twice a week. He came out one night, hugged us as he always did, and said, "Dad, I feel so different. I feel really different." He said, "Dad, I'm sleeping through the night now. I haven't done that since I was a child. I can focus, Dad. My mind's not racing all day. I'm teaching as a person, Dad." I said, "Well, what are they doing to you?" So, "Well, I see a counselor here. She's pretty good, Dad. And I take medication. I take it at night and in the morning. It's really changed me, Dad." I knew he failed him. I should have known something. He was like that for the balance of his time. He was pretty brave about it. I was on the Supreme Court. 20% of my day job was hearing appeals from the very population he was living with 24/7. You might imagine I wasn't Mr. Popular at the state prison. "Keep your way for 3 a.m. at the church house." He said, "Dad, don't leave the court." "I wouldn't." He said, "You work too hard. If it gets bad here, I'll let you know, but don't leave." He never asked me to. After 3 years, he was up for parole, and I tried to condition him, and he probably wouldn't get it because I was Chief Justice, and it's going to look funny. it's going to be funny. I don't think they're going to do it. They told me. And the day of this parole hearing, it was pretty clear they were going to grant it. My wife and I came out of the hearing, and there was a camera there from Channel 9. A young woman who probably knew nothing about Shorey put the lens in front of our face, and she said to me, "Do you have anything you want to say?" I said, "Actually, I do." So we're really happy my son is leaving and coming back to ordinary life. But I want to tell you something else. My son's not a bad person. He's now suddenly a good person. He's always been a good person. He's now a lover. And those are very different things. My son, who was crazy every day for years, has now had a drop of alcohol in over 50 years. He said, "Dad, I'm not that guy anymore. I'm that guy. I don't feel like that guy. I used to feel that." That first Thanksgiving, he and I were driving, heading home in 4 years. We were driving to pick up some last minute item, and he was in the passenger seat, tapping his chest like this. He said, "Dad, can you always spell like this?" I said, "What do you mean like this?" He said, "Good, I mean that like I feel." I said, "Dad, I hardly have it. I knew we had failed you. I knew we had failed." He said to me during that trip, he said, "Dad, I should have told you this, but when I was in the prison, they gave me an IQ test. I knew he was smart, I was curious. So I said, how did you do on that?" So they told me I was 3 points above genius on the test. So I was kidding him. I said, "You couldn't be a genius?" He said, "Yeah, my ankles were shackled, and they were watching me through a two-way mirror. I must be worth 3 points." I don't know if it is or not. He's a lot smarter than his father. I know that. I love my son. I'm the last guy on earth to be here today. I was thinking about that as I walked in. Life is funny. It's the most important work I've done in my entire lifetime. I didn't do anything, by the way, when my son was incarcerated. I was kind of hoping nobody read the paper. I knew that wasn't realistic. But for that first year, people would come up to me, perfect strangers, grocery stores, gas pumps, star of the season, didn't matter. "Hey, Judge, you're looking good." I knew it, didn't I? I said, "Thanks, I'm feeling better. My son's feeling better, too." "Oh, I didn't want to ask you about your son." I said, "That's okay. We saw alcohol, and we didn't see you." He's doing much better now. And then every one of those people, strangers to me, would open up. My mother, my father, my cousin, my brother, my sister, my best friend. Sometimes they open up about themselves. I heard about anxiety, depression, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, suicide attempts. This baby boomer was highly. I said to my wife, "We thought we were alone down there in the valley down the road. There's a lot of families there. We just thought it was tough." I didn't do anything. I know what I've done. 7 years ago, I got involved in a campaign that brings me here today. It was a product of a psychologist in Maryland who was on Time Magazine's 100 list in 2012. Her name was Barbara Van Dalen. She wanted to start a nationwide campaign so people would understand the five most common signs of mental illness, as we understand and know the signs for heart attack and stroke. Most of us know those now. We didn't know those. Now we call 911. I thought it was genius. I got involved in the campaign and helped raise money for it. I hadn't done anything in the years that have happened in the meantime. And when I raised money, it was the easiest money I ever raised. I was dean of law school at UNH at one time, so I know what raising money is supposed to feel like. It didn't feel like that. Everyone gave me money, and everyone gave me money out of mental health story somewhere. We launched this nonpartisan, non-political campaign. Does that exist anymore in America, by the way? Nonpartisan, non-political campaign on mental health. We used the empty statehouse in Concord, the House Chamber. The Speaker said we could use it. They weren't in session. I thought, who's counting this on a Monday morning at 10 a.m.? I thought it would fail before it started. It wasn't exactly a Bernie Sanders speech. It was an empty statehouse. My wife and I got to that morning, there were over 425 people there. It was the single most impressive room I'd ever seen assembled in my life here. Because they pictured the jail, the Episcopal Church, the Jewish community, the Attorney General, our attack, the Russian delegation, our government, three members of the Supreme Court, law enforcement, CEOs of all kinds, and families. Barbara Vandetta was there that day, and she asked this question of the most impressive room I've ever been in the year. Does anyone in this chamber this morning, she said, who's been untouched by no help? Yourself, your family, your extended family, your friends, your co-workers, your neighbors. If you've ever been touched by it, she said, raise your hand. I had no idea what to expect. So I was scanning the room to see how many hands went up to find who had been untouched. Not one hand. Not one hand. Meaning every single person had been touched. I said, well, afterwards, Barbara, how is that possible? Said, John, it happens in almost every room. I ask the question, just because people don't talk about it doesn't mean they and their families aren't doing it. She shared these statistics. 1 in 5 adolescents in the United States, 1 in 5, reported to your future workforce, has a diagnosable mental health problem. 1 in 5 adults do too. Do the math, tens of millions of people. Last year in the United States, over 48,000 people took their own lives. More than a family car. More than every traffic accident in the country. Every 90 minutes, every day, including this day, some brave American veteran, he or she, will end their own lives. We just saw a veteran today in American suicide. Are we okay with that? Don't talk about it much. Do you realize last year more police officers in America and first responders in America died by suicide than every other cause in the line of duty combined? From 2007 to 2017, according to the CDC, the rate of suicide for people ages 10 to 24 increased 56%. And that just happened for no reason. 2019, the Center for Disease Control conducted anonymous surveys in public high schools. Your age, your sex, your year in school, that's it. 70 high schools in the Hampshire took it that year, taken all around the country. 46.6% of high school girls in the United States of America 2019, before COVID, were depressed. The question doesn't say, are you depressed? It said, have you been sad or hopeless for 2 consecutive weeks or longer in the last 12 months that you haven't been able to engage in normal everyday activity? 26% of high school girls. 25% of high school girls on survey said they had given serious consideration to suicide in the previous 12 months. 15% said they had made plans to kill themselves. 11.3% of high school girls nationwide pre-COVID said they had attempted suicide one or more times. It's 8.3% in Hampshire, by the way, 8.9% in Maine. Can you imagine if 46% of high school girls in America had COVID, or diabetes, or cancer of any kind? It would be a public health emergency. The Surgeon General of the United States last December issued an advisory, which is an unusual thing to do. He described what's happening with adolescents in America as a national crisis, as well as to our health. The American Academy of Pediatrics, not exactly a well-trained shop, last July described it as a national emergency. It's immoral. It's immoral that we live in this country or not do. I'm not blaming anyone. I'm blaming all of us for where we find ourselves. Over the last 6 years after we lost that campaign, we waited to see if anyone would ask us to speak anywhere. Over those 6 years, I've spoken 680 or 690 times in 5 states, and sometimes beyond, 140,000 people. attended 300 middle schools and high schools. I hugged more kids and women with wet eyes and cracking voices than anyone alive. Not because I'm special, but because I'm vulnerable. And I'm willing to open to these kids and they're willing to return the favor. If you were with me on those trips to gyms and auditoriums and heard what I've heard, hugged what I've hugged, you would say, this is not right. What are we doing about it? You're here today to talk about the state workforce and the future of it. I've interviewed your future workforce. In the United States, every year now, businesses writ large lose between $100 and $200 billion a year because of mental health and substance issues. I thought, how is that possible? You train people. People spend a lot of time and money training people, and they don't stay because of mental health issues theirs or something they love. Absenteeism from work, one of the big drivers of absenteeism is mental health, either the employees or some of their work. Some economists came up with the term presenteeism. You're present at work, but you might as well be home 2.5 days a month because you're not focused and nobody wants to talk about it. Any future workplace in the history of public or private, if you want to attract and retain this rather incredible generation, I love these kids. They're not coming and they're not staying because they're not dealing with what they're experiencing. It's that simple. Having good policies, having good work practices, having good insurance, it's not just a nice thing, it's an economic imperative. Whatever the generation was that came before me, they showed up at work, they did the best they could, they put in a lot of hours, they worked hard. These kids will too, but will be different, will be very different. The amount of anxiety and depression among young people is epidemic. We can pretend that's not true. I know it's good. I know what the stats say, and I'll play the stats. They don't suddenly leave their car in the morning, come into the workplace, and feel 100%. Maybe that was always necessary, but I think it's more necessary now than ever. Everyone in this room probably develops social emotional strengths, eyeball to eyeball. That's the world I'm talking about. Not here. There's no social emotional growth on an iPad or an iPhone. I'm not anti-tech, I have both of those. But I also have this. They don't. They don't even understand. I talked to a pediatrician who said, let me tell you the difference between kids 25 years ago and today. Kids today don't look in the eye. So the parents can read the exam rooms now, that's good. But they don't even look up themselves, they're all doing this. It's true. I spoke this morning with Paul Booth on my intervention at the New Hampshire Insurance Department. We do not have in the United States of America in 2022 a mental health system. Hard stuff. It used to be like that for breast cancer, by the way. It used to be that way for HIV/AIDS, not that. It used to be that way for ALS. That's an ice bucket challenge, not that. Magic Johnson left the NBA in 1991, said I have HIV. We thought he was announcing his own death. And we love Magic. We love Larry Bird, but we still love Magic. And we didn't want to lose Patrick, and he's very much alive, by the way. We need that Patrick Johnson moment for mental health. We don't have a mental health system. Will Torrey is the head of psychiatry at GH. I love you, Harvard Medical, late 50s. I said to him on a public hearing, or someone did on a public hearing, I said, hey, doctor, how would you rate the mental health system in America? This was a year ago. 1 being terrible, 10 being the gold standard. He said, I would rate it a 1 or a 2. What? I spoke to the head of mental health at every university in Atlanta. It's very impressive. He holds the Wilson Carter Chair in Mental Health. I said, doctor, give me a rating, 1 to 10, 10 being the best. He said, John, I can't do that. I said, why is that? He said, we don't have a mental health system in the United States. That was March 2021. Are we okay with it? The folks that I've met, these kids who I love, they're smarter than we were, they're more worldly wise than I ever was. And they're the least judgmental generation of Americans in the history of our country. But they have issues we didn't have. They're growing up in a world most of us don't remember from our childhood. We're shortening childhood in America. We're professionalizing childhood in America. These kids are under stress. These kids are afraid to fail. Whatever that means to them. I know that. They share that with me. Some of them are ashamed to tell their parents about their mental health concerns. They're going to come to your workplace. They're not going to leave those in the car. I spoke this morning with Paul Booth. A woman came up to me afterwards and told her down. He said, I'm ashamed of my problems. I almost cried when he was speaking. What is that? If you have a bad back or breast cancer, you should be talking about it. And we'll all be supporting you. That's what I'm talking about. And so you sit here and think about the future workload at levels I'm sure I can't understand. I can tell you this, the young people who are going to lead this state, the private posts and public posts, a lot of them are immensely talented, and a lot of them suffer. It doesn't get better just because you're older. And if you're hiding it, it's worse. Let me close with this. I was in Portsmouth High School about 3 weeks ago. I spoke to 1,100 kids in a gym. I'm probably the oldest guys I've spoken to. And they listen to you, the grandfather they don't know. Not the son, me, it's this topic. And afterwards, kids come up. Some of them are watching athletes, some of them are kids who are recently suffering. One kid came out, he had crutches, his ankle was bandaged, he had a friend carrying his foot. I said, what happened to you? He said, I injured myself playing basketball. I said, hey, you know what mental health is like? It's like saying to someone with a mental health problem, you really do need crutches. You should have your ankle bandaged. And somebody should be helping as a push button. You can't do that. So I don't want you to, I want you to pretend you're fine. Throw the crutches down, take the bandage off, and take gym. And don't share it. This boy with his sprained ankle is having all these people helping. We're fine with physical injury. From the neck down, we're totally on board. From the neck up, it's almost like we're afraid to go there. And Will Torrey, the head of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins, said to me, treatment works. Most mental health people are private pay, not because they're making lots of money, but because they don't get reimbursed at the same rate as procedural medicine. That's why they're private pay. Why do you tell me that? I've had parents say to me, I can't get my son or daughter in to see you in 4 or 5 months. If the son or daughter fell and broke their ankle and called 911, there'd be an ambulance there within 10 minutes. That's what I'm talking about. Any consideration of what the future workplace needs to be and look like, it needs to be mental health friendly and supportive. And if it isn't, they're not coming and they're not staying after they arrive. I want to ask Paul Booth, who's back there from the older patient, what's that with me? Paul Booth is the head of the Employment Assistance for the state. every company should have a call booth. And if you're a state employee or a family member under 26, she's free. And how free can you do? So I hope you're good with your attention. And I want to thank the commissioner for letting me come. I'm sorry to go on, but it's just like she's a sheep. And we need to fix it.
I say this every time I work with Chief Justice. Following him is a very difficult thing. Thank you so much for your honesty and vulnerability. Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner, thank you for having me. My name is Paula Booth, and I am the director of the State of New Hampshire Employee Assistance Program. We provide services to the three branches of government, state employees, and their family members. And as time has gone on, I've had the opportunity to, I would say, follow the Chief Justice in his message. And it's a message that we really have been trying to support for many years. I will tell you, I've worked for the state for 36 years, and in the first year of my employment, I called the Employee Assistance Program. And for those of you that don't know what that is, it's a program that's made available to the employees around any issue that may challenge their ability to be productive in the workplace. When I made that call 36 years ago, I was looking for somebody who was told that I would be able to problem solve. And so now here I am, 36 years later, and I'm the director of that program. And my thought at that time, decades ago, was that I'm a healthy person looking for help. And that's our philosophy today. And what we're really trying to do is have people find their voice to be able to talk about this so that we can remove the stigma. It's been a challenging couple of years, as you know. It continues to be, and I have the best job in the world that I get to help and support the employees that are providing services. But when you think about some of the people, other than the Chief Justice that has spoken out, some of you will probably recognize Naomi Osaka, who was the tennis star that was being interviewed. And she decided at that interview that she did not want to continue because she was having a lot of anxiety. So she was taking care of herself. And the reward she got for taking care of herself was a $16,000 fine. Now here she is on the front of the Time magazine with the quote, "It's okay not to be okay." This pandemic is the only shared experience that I can think of that has touched everyone. And it is okay not to be okay. And to not hide and pretend. There's another person, and many of you have heard of others, Kevin Love, who's been talking about it, right? Prince Harry. And then we've got Simone Biles, right? Who had the pressure of the Olympics, and I know it was a little controversial, but she stepped away because she said her mind and body weren't in tune for her to do the work that she was there for. I disagree. I think she was listening to her mind, which is what kept her safe during that time. There's a gentleman from the North Country, and for those of you that are from the North Country, you might recognize his name, Wayne Saunders. Wayne Saunders was a former fish and game officer that was involved in an event that happened up in Colebrook about 25 years ago. And a couple of years ago, Wayne called me and said, "I just wanted to tell you I'm retiring today. So he'd made it through his career. And I want to thank you." Now this really isn't about me. The purpose of this, me mentioning this, is what his message is. And what his message is that because he was able to get assistance following that event, he was able to continue his career, which is what we're hoping the next generation is going to be able to do, right, with the support. And his message now to law enforcement and others is that it is okay to ask for help. We did a podcast together where his message, and he has said it's okay that I use his name, is that it is okay to ask for help. Now, when I was over at the insurance department this morning, I asked the group these questions. If you were building a house and you had to wire it, would you hire an electrician? If you had a plumber, would you hire a plumber? If you had a complicated tax situation, might you use an accountant? We already ask for help in so many ways. We should incorporate this in us asking for help as well. Treatment does work. And now that we are talking about this, the stigma is coming down a little bit. But we want to keep the momentum. And sometimes the workplace is the safest place for somebody to get help. It might be the only place. It might be the place during a break where they can make a call. It might be the place that if they have a sick leave policy that they're able to see a clinician or a doctor. So we want to make sure that the workplace is responsive to the needs of the employees and the people that are coming through. And I will say, there is a difference between when I came into work and some of the people that I'm working with now. The 36-year employee, like I am, sometimes is a little scarce, right? But those people that we're hiring now are sharp, they're skilled, and they've been through everything that we've been through. And so it is okay not to be okay, and it is okay to talk about it. And if you can connect with somebody that can be helpful, or your employees can have faith and trust that somebody can be helpful, it can make all the difference to your bottom line. And I do know, because I do have the best job in the world, supporting employees, I do know that there are situations where people's work life has been saved, or their personal life has improved and it's affected the bottom line of work. The Chief Justice and I want to get this message out to anyone that will listen. We do have difficult times. And even though we are, as I refer to, coming out of the cave of COVID a little bit, we're still facing some monumental issues. And so if we tap the brakes, we're going to miss the opportunity to move forward. And so I encourage you to be looking at what are the resources that are available, what can be enhanced, are they visible to people, do they know how to access them, is there an educational campaign that needs to be done, who can you have to come in and speak like the Chief Justice that can make a difference to your employees. You can well imagine them standing up in front of an auditorium of 6th or 12th graders and a line that follows them out the door, just like what happened this morning. So please, if there's anything that I can do to support the work that you do, I am the director of the State of New Hampshire EAP. I'm happy to give some guidance if it's possible. I do a little bit of work with a couple of different hospitals. I'm not the expert on everything, but I might have some thoughts that you haven't considered. And so I'm going to close with this one example of a woman that came to me and how we were able to make a difference in her work life and her personal life. Now remember, healthy people ask for help, and not everyone has to be in crisis when they call. This mom asked to meet with me, and when she sat down, she said, "I know you don't give money, give away money, but I just need somebody to hear my story." And this is what she said. "I have a son who has a significant anxiety issue. And we've done everything that parents typically do. We've contacted a guidance counselor, we've had therapy, we dealt with medication. The best thing that we ever did for our son was to enroll him in karate." Now, this isn't about being able to beat somebody up, it's about being defensive, but it's the culture of what karate had to offer. "And it made a significant difference in this child's life, as well as family. However, her partner lost his job, and they could no longer afford to send their child to karate. Now I'm sitting there and thinking, how am I going to help this person? And she's pulled on my heartstrings, and they've done everything that they can do. So I asked her, how do they market this program? And she said they have what they call Buddy Day. Now, Buddy Day is when he would bring a friend of his to class. They'd get a free lesson. They'd get a white belt at the end of the lesson with the hope that they might enroll. I said, "Have you done that?" And she said, "Oh, yes." I said, "Has anybody enrolled in the program?" Three people. So I'm thinking she's brought in a little bit of revenue. This family is supporting the dojo. I said, "Have you spoken to the sensei about what's going on in your family?" And she said, "No." I said, "How about if you give them a call and go visit and talk about the situation and remind them of what you've done and tell them that you would continue doing that?" She said, "Well, that's an idea." So she went and she talked to the sensei, and about 2 weeks later, I got an email that said they gave that family 6 months free lessons. We might not have the answer for everything, but we might have a thought that people haven't had before. And because we service so many different agencies and the three branches of government, we benefit from the experience that we gain working with them. So my point is, if we can point people in a direction where there is help, treatment does work. It doesn't always have to be a crisis. It can make a difference in the workforce and in their family life. So again, thank you for having me today. Thank you, Chief Justice, for your part in this. And if there's anything that I can do in the future, please don't hesitate to call me. Thank you.
I want to thank the Chief Justice and Paul for coming tonight and sharing this information with us. This is the second time that I've heard the Chief Justice and Paul back when we had the Commissioner's Group meeting, and this story is just as powerful now as it was back then. There's no more important topic that needs to be addressed and taken care of in this state. I want to thank you for your commitment going all over, not just the country, but other United States. Talk about this is doing the outreach, because that is very, very important. And I want to thank you for your great commitment.
I appreciate all the time. I really do. I need your help, is what I need.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about next. So, first off, before you leave, anybody have any questions they'd like to ask? Either the Chief Justice or Paul, if you could just please identify.
You know all my days, so. It's been a privilege, actually. Thank you.
One of the things that Joe and I have spoken about too is obviously this is a very, very important topic, and we're losing people through mental health issues that can't be actively engaged in the community, whether they're going through the school process, whether they're going into employment. And one of the boards that we have is the Workforce Development Policy Committee. And that's, we're thinking about possibly having a subcommittee to continue this dialogue and to continue this going along. So if any of you have any desire to serve on that subcommittee, please reach out to John and let him know. And with that, we're going to continue with the board motions and discussion. Again, this is Mr. George Pataz of Department of Security. Before speaking, we're going to move on to the board motions and discussion portions of the agenda. Before speaking, please state your name so that the transcription service can accurately document this meeting. Please also state your name when you make a motion, a second motion, and Joe, please guide us through these items.
Thank you, Commissioner, again, for the record, Joe Dorian, for the staff report. Again, thank you. And I know it's kind of difficult for repeating your name each time. It helps with the transcription service and saves us money. We try to be good stewards of public funds, so it does save us quite a bit. Mr. Chairman, just noting that we had three board members join us during Joseph Broderick's presentation, Christine Brennan, John Hennessy, and Tina Kasem, so just adding them, and we still have way more than a quorum, so we're doing great. If I could draw your attention to the board members on page 119, item 2B, for informational items, for new, for returning board members, I think you can remember, we provide, again, these documents in advance that you can review. Informational items are exactly that. They don't require a motion, but they can always, if there's a motion that comes from that, if you can wait until section 3 to make them, and so we can keep things organized. But these informational items serve as reporting out from staff to the board. And we certainly have different staff members that can answer questions. We try to refrain from giving a total presentation because, again, that's why we provide the packet in advance. So we try not to rehash things that are, of course, provided in front of you. Lisa Gerard, Lisa, do you mind leaving this for folks? Lisa Gerard is happy to take any questions about item 2B if there are any from members of the board. I will say, real fast, these are performance measures that we have to be held accountable by the U.S. Department of Labor. For new board members, it's put out by a statistical model from the U.S. Department of Labor, but we do have the opportunity to negotiate and push back. We did exactly that, and the feds kind of came to our negotiations, so OOF staff is available if you need to buy a car, host this meeting, because apparently we're pretty good at that. So it's part of a process. Again, U.S. Department of Labor funds are very formulaic and very prescriptive, so whenever there's flexibility within that, we try to exercise that. So that's item 2B. Mr. Chairman, can I continue?
Yes. Any questions? Anybody? Okay.
Item 2C, Mr. Chairman, is rapid response update, and I know we have Jimmy Hinson here. Jimmy, do you mind waving? And Jimmy, do you mind just taking 30 seconds to explain what rapid response is? Maybe a little bit more than that, but a brief, what is rapid response? Because it might be a term for board members, and also maybe report out a little bit of what's happening, just to familiarize the board members.
I'd be happy to. Jimmy Hinson, Office of Workforce Opportunity. Rapid response is when any business closes or has a layoff or suffers an emergency like a fire. An example of that would have been the Red Lantern. After discussion with them, they ended up closing down operations, laying off a good percentage of their workforce. So in a nutshell, that's what encompasses rapid response. We get called in mandatory. It's a mandatory visit where we have to outreach if it's 25 or more. But in the state of New Hampshire, we are trying to get the yes a lot easier. So anytime there's a layoff of any number, we respond, whether it's one person or several hundred. The services that we provide is basically taking all of the services that are in NHWorks one-stop systems, bringing them as a team on location, or providing that information on the internet, and then making sure that they understand how to file for unemployment, how to look for dislocated work or other training programs, how to get the help they may need with the Community Action Program. If they run into child care or health issues, we have the Department of Health and Human Services. If they haven't done any interviewing in a while, there's the community college system that can help with the Work Ready New Hampshire program. And if they're individuals with disabilities, we also have and make sure that we have people that can assist them moving forward. So that's a general overview of Rapid Response. Any questions on that? I would say as far as where we're standing right now, we're in good shape. We're only seeing, as of today, we only have 12 Rapid Response activities, which is 13 fewer than last year at this time. However, when you're looking at those 12, you're talking about 523 people impacted. One of the great things that I can tell you is when we do the rapid responses, the minimal stability of people losing their jobs, wondering what's going to happen with them is tremendous. Having a team on site to answer questions or either give a person a phone number and say, you know, for in this case, call Stephen. Stephen will work with you. And then I pick up the phone and call Stephen and say, this person's going to be calling you to make sure that connection takes place. We have a one-on-one connection with our rapid response teams, and it really does make a difference. We are doing rapid responses in person. There's a lot of communication that you can't get when you're doing it over Zoom, and a lot of emotional fatigue that you can see in a person. You can approach them separately after a presentation to help meet their needs better. We have also updated our reemployment guide, which we give out to every person. And that way, when they're in that fog and they're listening to a presentation and they're not necessarily capturing it all, it's all included in that tri-fold, you know, along with point of contact phone numbers and email addresses. And of course, they can contact you or myself at any time. We are also doing visits to each one of our 12 Innings Works offices, continuing to do training, continuing to update our materials. So far to date, we've been able to visit 12, or 6 of the 12 offices in person and talk to staff, and we're going to put the other 6 by the remainder of this year. The one, I think, caution that we're looking at, we are seeing businesses kind of hunker down. They're stopping the hiring, they're stopping the buying, they're having trouble hiring new people. So whenever there is a rapid response, we get overwhelming response with other employers wanting to hire them. So that's on the good side. However, we're still seeing this as an opportunity for those people to get trained and upskilled in training dollars that we have through the WIOA program, the Dislocated Worker Program, the Adult and Youth Programs. We're going to continue to promote those programs. And the other thing is we are preparing, Sarah and I worked with the interagency business team to re-update the reemployment guide. The 300 I had set aside for myself based on last year's and the previous year's numbers, we're already halfway through that. There's two rapid responses. The Red Lantern and the Baker firm took half of those guides, so I printed another 1,000, and we are optimistic still, but I'm anticipating an uptick in potential rapid responses as we go into next year. Businesses tend to be hunkering down, but with the rising cost of fuel, with the rising heating cost and equipment cost and supply chain issues, all out of our control, we just want to be ready and prepared if businesses have to make those tough calls. Anything more to add?
Thank you, Jimmy. Any questions? Jimmy? So please just state your name. Questions? Nobody? Okay, let's move on to
Item 2G is a financial update. If there are questions to the part of the team, Mark, you might be waving for understanding that. And one thing, forgive me, but for returning board members, you all know Laura. For returning board members to Laura, Laura is actually upset to say leaving us on June 17th will be her last day. She's still in state government. Our loss is the Department of Administrative Services game. We're going to miss her tremendously. So if anybody has a really, really tough question for her, on her way out the door, we would happily entertain that, but Laura has been just an integral member of the OO team, so those are big shoes to fill, but we're sad to see her go. We're excited to see her new opportunities. It's a great position. Commissioner Arlen helps us very lucky. I'm very sad, but does anyone feel sorry?
No.
So we're going to miss you, but it, you know, any tough questions for Laura?
Have you replaced your debt?
No. Working on that.
That's such a tension.
There's a workforce crisis. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Certainly been a pleasure to work for the office and to serve the force. So thank you.
Okay, item 2, the performance update.
Item 2E, this is happy to answer any questions that might have any questions that might be relevant to 2E.
Any questions, anybody?
For new board members, we always include success stories. Returning board members might remember, but this time last year we had several program participants, and I, like many people, had a sudden allergy attack of the eyes and some really, really good stories. So we're hoping to have some program participants at the next meeting for you all, so that you can hear and not just see the numbers and performance data and winning the stories, but actually have an opportunity to interact and talk about these life changing programs. Happy to entertain Jeremy. Any questions on 2F?
Questions, anybody? Okay, we move on to G. Sorry,
thank you, Commissioner Kencho Dorman, Office of Workforce Opportunity. We are looking for volunteers, we being, of course, the board. Speaking with Chairman Kane, certainly wanted to try to put out a volunteer opportunity first before the kind of the draw names from a hat sort of deal. We have three standing committees for our bylaws. They are the Review Committee, which is currently comprised of Kelly Clark, Tina Kasem, and Tim Sink. Sorry, Tim, my coffee's wearing off. Thank you, and we thank the Review Committee for the hard work they put in so far. We, of course, would love other folks to join to maybe step out, especially if there might be a conflict or if just people are away on vacation or just to give people a break. So we're looking for at least three board members for the three committees. We have 32 members of the board, so we'd really love to have volunteers. And if you would like to volunteer for any of those committees, Melissa, do you mind raising your hand? I believe you all have Melissa Salmon's email, and we'd be really appreciative for any volunteers, especially having heard from Justice Broderick earlier, which would be a conversation, how to carry that conversation forward and look at ideas. That would be like the work of the Workforce Development Policy Committee. So if what you heard earlier has inspired you to action, you'd like to keep the conversation going and how we can implement that into the workforce system, that'd be a great example there. So, of course, we can always chat after the meeting, but please contact Melissa directly and we can put together information for that.
Thanks, Chuck. Okay, we're going to move on to board motions and discussions. Item 3A, eligible training provider letter.
Thank you, Commissioner. Lisa Gerard, do you mind taking this item off?
So in the board packet, there is a letter that was drafted by OO. Basically, our eligible training provider list is growing and is getting ever bigger. This is our first performance year that all student data needs to be reported to USCOL. We have received a waiver that we did not have to provide the state of this program here. So we want to encourage our eligible training providers to give us that data so that they can remain on our list. If they fail to provide the data, the performance data for this program year, they will be dropped. So we thought that it might be something that the board would get behind and draft a letter. And if that's something that we're all interested in doing, we could send that out to all of our eligible community providers that are currently on our list.
Questions?
Thank you, Joel. I'll take it for the record. Is this performance data specific to like names of students, or is it holistic data?
So it would be social security numbers is what we're looking for, because that way we can match wage data in order to show performance. So it would be student data, and it would be obviously protected in the system. It's basically uploaded into our system so that then that data can be cross-matched within the wage data system.
Thank you.
Other questions? Not as a motion. Is that second? Mary Hansen. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, item 3D, in demand occupation.
Thank you, Commissioner. Again, for record, Joe Dorian. I will, I guess, keep this off, and then Lisa will correct me where I leave off. So the high-paid occupation list is something that we put together over 2 years for returning board members. This is something that, again, comes up at least once a term. We work with our partners at New Hampshire Employment Security to put together this high-demand occupation list. Any position on this list allows us or unlocks the opportunity to train dollars within the WIOA Workforce and Pay Opportunity Act system. So this is a required action that we have to take every 2 years per the federal requirement. You'll see in there that it's 106 positions. But the criteria is minimum 106 openings annually with a minimum wage rate of $11 an hour. And now that might trigger a question. You say, Joe, I'm looking everywhere, and most places are hiring above $11 an hour. Correct. But we wanted to make sure, and again, whenever you'll see kind of a consistent theme is whenever the feds try to give us some leeway, we try to utilize that to make things easier for frontline staff to have more people come into the programs. Again, it's about access and unlocking and allowing folks to utilize these dollars. So we acknowledge that wages have gone up. We are not blind to that. However, if we increase the wage requirements on that, we could find some other jobs potentially being knocked off the list. And we don't want to see that. So that's stuff that, you know, we were kind of worried about, like LNAs, for instance, which is, I think we can all agree, a very, very in-demand occupation that we desperately need. But on top of that, you know, the goal being inclusivity and protecting us from the volatility of the labor market. We're unsure as to where we're going to be 6 months from now or 2 years. You know, it's, I think, my first board meeting a few years ago, we're talking about, you know, $12 an hour being high. Now we're talking about $11 being low. So things have changed. So we put together this list with our partners in employment security, and it requires a board motion for us to be able to continue.
Questions? Anybody? John? Lisa? Not, is there a motion to approve?
So moved to the revision.
Oh, second.
Second, Justin Campbell.
Second. Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Support item 3C, support services chat.
And Commissioner Andrew, going from the record, we're going to kick that over to Lisa, who's still standing.
Lisa Gerard, Office of Workforce Opportunity. So under the VOA programs, that's our adults, disability worker, and youth, we have a set category for support services, which can encompass a whole range of different things that we can help provide to participants to remove barriers from employment and for training. So right now, our participant cost or cap is $1,000 per program year per participant.
So we are looking at increasing that to $1,500 per year per participant. There is also a waiver process in place that should we get to that cap of $1,500, you can have the participant, the case manager, submit a waiver process, and we can at OO approve it, so they can actually increase that cap beyond $1,500. But looking at the situation, looking at gas prices and child care and housing and all of the different things that we can provide, the increase has just been astronomical. So we thought increasing the support service cap to the $1,500 would be appropriate. So that's the motion for the request.
Okay. Any questions, anybody? Yes.
Hi, I'm new, so I just don't understand how the information just really lays out. But can you explain where the facility impact of this increase comes from?
Can you speak up a little bit?
I'm asking, we have no problem with promotion. I just am curious as to what the fiscal impact more broadly of raising this funding amount is. Like, where does that money come from? Does it have to be offset? Does it reduce funding that's available for some other type of use?
So, and we're happy to kind of, again, for the record, Joe Dorian, and we have, I can look at Laura if I misspeak or Lisa, but we took a look at the numbers prior. The feds give us the ability, the flexibility to raise and increase that. For new members, you might remember the training, $6,500 for training, currently $1,000 for supportive services, and $5,500 for on-the-job training. So we took a look at staff to recognize the fact that inflation, everything is increasing. Certainly child care, that falls under an eligible expense under this item, including gas and transportation. So we tried to put together a conservative estimate that would protect the integrity of the program. We're comfortable with the $1,500, and it comes from the greater pot, if you will, that we have come to us. So we wouldn't be pulling away on services for folks. We've actually seen increases in our allocation during the financial report and the numbers. And I think we have, in item 3E, we talk about a little bit more of when we receive funds, how we receive funds, and what funds we can spend on. The increase will, of course, require more money to come out of that specific supportive services line item, but we will have enough to cover everybody because we're seeing more funds come from the federal government, and we anticipate that, but we also need to have carryover too. So from a financial standpoint, we're going to be fine. And it's a change that I think will, for frontline staff, save money on the back end, so we're not doing a million waivers where they're charging more and more time. So we took a look at the numbers. We came to 1,500. Other states, in Vermont, is 3,000. That would be a big jump, but we have, we're normally a minimally funded state from the U.S. Department of Labor. We're like us, Wyoming, Vermont, smaller states, smaller populations, we get the bare minimum funding. As you can imagine, California, since it's formulaic, receives, I think the city of Los Angeles gets more than us in Vermont and Maine combined. So with COVID, we saw our unemployment rate shoot up. Unfortunately, Commissioner Capaz knows too well. So the feds pumped more money into the program, and everybody saw an increase in funding. So I'm sorry if I'm going off on too much of a tangent. I hope that was helpful. And if not, Lisa and Laura are much smarter than me and can probably answer the question better.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
Mayor Kelly, I just have a question on the waiver process. Is there a cap to the waiver after? That's to how much additional funds they can apply to us after.
There is not. So we don't have a cap on the waiver, but each waiver is looked at specifically as to that case. So we look at the case in general, we look at the specifics as to what's happening with that participant and what the request is for. Sometimes the waiver is a one-time waiver for an additional, $100 a year. But each waiver is looked at specifically for that participant based on their particular needs.
Okay.
Mary Valley, one follow up question. Is there data that shows how much money has been spent through waivers that we did miss that in the
So the waiver process is in place internally. And it's not reported anywhere, but I do track it. So every request that comes in to the OO office, no matter which program it's for, I track them and make sure, you know, as to what we're seeing for waivers, which is the exact reason why this has kind of come up, because we haven't seen more and more additional waivers at the $1,000 cap.
Any other questions? Okay, I'll entertain a motion. Motion. Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item 3D topics for the October 4th meeting.
So, thanks, Commissioner, again, for the very good story and workforce opportunity. This serves as an opportunity. Justice Rogers' presentation is a direct result of conversations of exactly 3D of Commissioner Capatas mentioning the importance and the work that Justice Rogers has done. So, as staff, we want to be responsive to members of the board, and we try to look for one to two topics each board meeting, so that next for the October meeting, staff can sit together and seek out presenters for the board to help inform decision making relative to work decisions.
Mayor, George Hansel, just one suggestion. There's a lot going on in higher education right now between the university system and the community college system. It would be great to understand how the responses of those systems would impact this board and the work that we're doing.
Others? Any others?
Yes. Justin Chandler. In the fire service, I think it's no denial that we are losing members left and right, and the attraction to the industry seems to be dwindling. We have a couple different, I know we spoke at the training program, that there's a recruitment and retention committee that was formed at the Fire Academy. Obviously, there's a lot of different state agencies. I'm here kind of on behalf of the professional firefighters of New Hampshire, which is the state affiliate for the labor organizations. But it doesn't just affect our career departments, it's obviously volunteering as well. I'd love to get someone here to speak more to what are those issues or what has been identified of why we don't have people getting into this workforce anymore.
I'm sorry, why?
Why people aren't entering the workforce of first responders anymore.
I'll check with our economic labor market director bring something to the table on that, and just the workforce in general to address as well some of the issues. And the two big age brackets you have where people haven't returned to the labor force in the 60 to 64, and the 25 to 29, the big percentages of people are just not back in the labor force yet. I mean, obviously, the 25 to 29, you're not talking about 40-year retirement, so wanting to be back is just a question of when. And the 60 to 64, you know, I mean, with the whole COVID situation, and at that point, the 401k's right up, and the value of their homes way up, they just haven't come back into the labor force. Our numbers are down. So, when Joe brought it up earlier, we get shot up to 116,000 claims a week during the height of the pandemic, and now we're at about 1,500 claims a week, which is the lowest it's been since 1987. So people aren't coming back on unemployment. You know, they just aren't, and the numbers aren't there. But Brian could probably give an update on that as well, I think, to the whole board. And I'll check with Don availability. Anything else anybody has that they, I'm sorry, yes.
Patrick Paul. In part of the building trades, I'll just speak for, you know, construction trades in general, there's a serious disconnect between our construction industry countrywide, say, and the amount of participants that are women in the construction trades. It's like a fraction of a percent of our available workforce is 0.9% of our construction industry is, you know, occupied by women. And over half of our country's population is women. There's more women in our country than men. So we're missing out on half of our country, the entire trade, every trade, plumbers, pipefitters, electricians, everybody. You can name them all. You know who you are, who they are. There's a disconnect there. We need to fix that. I don't know how. I'm a simple plumber, pipefitter, but, you know, somebody knows how, or we need to come together and figure that out. So some there's, you know, obviously the blatant potential misogyny aspect of the construction industry, right? The trades got their reputation over time, right? I'm not saying, you know, it's unwarranted or whatever, but it has to change, obviously, and I think ideas have changed, but nobody realizes that. How do we make or help the trades become more palatable to women? How do we show them that it's a viable option for them, that that's a life choice that they can make for their family? Because there are wonderful jobs out there that you can feed families on for generations, you know, and they're missing out. There's a huge portion of funders who are missing out by me. Thank you.
I'm curious on what we're doing from state level to attract employees to our state. So to come from another state and say, hey, come to New Hampshire. I know, you know, a couple years ago we showed a lot of presentations, some videos and things we were doing, but what are we doing? Is our population going up? Is it going down? How do we draw more workers into the state? Are we doing things from the state level to do that? We've got a lot of advantages that other states don't have. And I just want to know how we're promoting that or how we might be able to help promote that.
I think Brian and I caught up to address that as well. Over the past 2 years, we've had 6,000 new employers that have come into the state, as well as in migration. It's been somewhere above 13,000 people.
Sure. It'd be interesting to see that. You've got new employers coming in, that's great. You've still got to fill the jobs.
Oh, yeah.
So all those jobs come in with the new people coming in. Is there a net add, and should we expect to see more, you know, is there a way to attract more employees from Mass, Maine, or Vermont, whatever?
I agree. I mean, you know, one of the big issues is housing. So
what's that?
Housing.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
You've got an agency rate that's less than 1%.
Yes.
It's tough to bring people in because where are they going to live?
Yeah. Right. Anyway, just to take a look at that.
Oh, I know.
I mean,
yeah.
We could talk about some of that.
Yes.
Quick question. Has the increase in New Hampshire workers' wages kept up with inflation? Do you have that?
I don't have that here, but I would say no.
Do it.
Yes.
Cameron Coheo. So we talked about mental health, right? So when we opened our doors back in 2015, we couldn't hire any mental health consultant because the amount of hours to take for someone to be certified, which is, I don't know, 6,000-7,000 hours, like in order for you to be kind of trained in the field. So we need to look at the requirement for someone to end up being certified mental health consultant or just counselor. I talked to Senator Shaheen way back in 2015, and she said that it's on the state level, not on the federal level, so it's really needed. I have like 120 students currently, and about 65 to 70 of them see the mental health consultant on a weekly basis.
I would say, Jonathan, that's an answer that note to follow up on that. Maybe afterwards you can come in and give a presentation on what the VOC does to expedite licensing in the state to support workforce needs.
Anybody else? You have all this stuff.
Yes, sir.
Trust.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It's going to be a busy next 2 meetings.
Okay, thanks everybody for those suggestions and all great suggestions.
3DWIOA master budget and distribution of funds for
Thank you, Chairman, and again to the record, Joe Dorian. And I'm going to try to take this over to Laura because I don't know how well I can answer Janet's questions, so I'm going to pass it over to Laura for this.
Thank you, Joe. Again, Laura Levine, the director. So 3E is kind of a narrative, and at the end of that, you can see the PY22 budget distribution. So for PY22, the funding that we're getting for EOA Title I is $7,319,728. You can see there the breakdown. So it's because, as Joe said earlier, it is formulaic. Really don't have much flexibility in the distribution other than the rapid response funding. The funding this year, we had a meeting and discussed rapid response. You're allowed to withhold up to 25% of dislocated workers funding for rapid response. For program year 22, we found that 17% seemed to be a good number for our office. And based on the need we're seeing, especially if we're seeing. So just for a little bit of background, because the narrative does go over it, but as we have a lot of board members, we always have Title I funding. We receive the funds, we have them for one program year, and then they're carried forward for two additional, so it's a total of three years. If you refer back to item 2B, it was an informational item. You can see the current status for us at the end of March, the funding that we have, not including these new funds for the new program year. And for reference, because of COVID, as Joe said, we are a minimally funded state. Because of COVID, we saw a big increase in funding in PY21, so that funding was awarded last July. It was about a $1 million increase, actually, and a little bit more than that from what we had seen the prior year. It was a large increase. This year, PY22, we're receiving about $700,000 less than last year. So we're still not back to even the minimum, but it has to do with the formula and force of employment. So a rather large swing, but again, we have 3 years to spend those funds. A little bit back to Chandler's question about support services. We do have those that funding available for that. 85% of adult and youth funding has to be withheld for the program. At least 65 dislocated worker, that depends again on how much is withheld for rapid response funds. So we've seen certainly increased need in support services. We do have the funding for that, so that is also why it's not taking away from any other parts of the program at this time. So this item is to approve the PY22 budget. Of course, if you have any questions about the budget or the allocation or the formula, the narrative does kind of go over it, but I'm also happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Anybody? Okay. There's a motion to approve. Question?
I'll approve. This is my
turn.
Second?
Second,
Mayor Bruchansen.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Sort of duties. 3F. Joe.
Mr. Chairman, again, Joe Dorian, Office of Opportunity. So, for returning board members, we've always historically had meetings on Tuesdays and avoid commitments of the Governor and Executive Council meetings where we don't want to have our state partners, where we have to, of course, that's really fun. And we avoid Thursdays and Fridays with the fiscal committee and other sort of commitments. I think on Fridays, I haven't been forever, which is great. So we have historically had meetings on Tuesdays, and we're just kind of keeping with the consistent schedule of meeting. Again, what staff is proposing, trying to avoid any major holidays. February 7th, 2023, June 6, 2023, and October 17, 2023. That allows for you all to plan well in advance for vacations and work commitments, and that allows for us as staff to make sure that we put together clear and concise and meaningful meetings for you all. So we put together three meeting dates for 2023. The previous board had approved this year's calendar, which I'm forgetting the next date of the meeting is in October, but that allows us again to plan. And the bylaws require three meetings a year. That allows us to, for RC 918 compliance, to post those dates on our website so the public knows and all that sort of stuff. So we try to make sure that we plan ahead, proper planning, and support performance.
Okay, thank you, John. Any questions? If not, I'll entertain a motion for those three dates, February 7th, June 6th, and October 17th, 2023.
Justin Cantor.
So, Justin, wait a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Subcommittee actions and reports.
And again, so we have a little typo here. The reviews committee did meet twice, but not on October 7th. And again, we had, we're very thankful to have dedicated members of the review committee, Kelly Clark, Tina Kaysen, and Tina and Singh. Myself and Lisa Gerard provided staff support as the review committee reviewed and scored two different RFPs. Those stand for request for proposals. The first being the Vibrant, Inclusive, and Prosperous program, a VIP program, which seeks to engage historically marginalized communities within the state. For those different communities to take part in the workforce system, we have a very vibrant, for instance, refugee New American community. And so those communities that we're trying to outreach to, again, and other historically marginalized groups as well in the state, again, trying to address the workforce shortage and trying to get these different populations into workforce training or into good, meaningful careers with upward mobility, and again, not jobs, but careers. So the State Workforce Innovation Board Review Committee approved two awards from the VIP program. Those two awards, the highest scoring was the International Institute of New England for an award of $561,635, followed by the second place score, Southern New Hampshire Services, for $638,365. The total allocation for that program was $1.2 million. So you might see, why did the first place finalists get less money? Well, that's what they put in for. So we met their budget exactly. We did talk with them over on their budget, make sure everything was fine. And then when that was approved, the review committee asked us to approach Southern New Hampshire Services. They had put in a higher bid and proposal, and we said how much money would be left on the table from that. And that was, and if they could work within those parameters, we had conversations from back and forth, and we settled on the $638,365 numbers you see. So a little bit, I guess, kind of doesn't make sense when you kind of take a look at it, but it makes sense if we kind of explain it. So again, the first, the top two choices were, the top choice was fully funded, and the second choice was partially funded. We also had, are there any questions about the VIP? Because I don't think before I just say any questions about the VIP program before I go to the state workforce assessment, or if Kelly or any other members before the review committee want to.
I don't have a question about the RFP process, but more about the service itself. Would that be appropriate? Yes. The community college system is going to be expanding our LPN programs, and one of our goals was to attract into the programs some of the same folks that we're talking about here, the previously marginalized population. Is this something where we partner, you know, kind of leverage what's already happening already to try to
Absolutely, and if I can add, we're partnering with the community college system. We provided, Chairman Kane provided a letter of support for that grant initiative in moving as an office supporting that through a number of means that they requested. So we talked to Becky Lewis and Beth Doran of the community college system. The VIP program is going to partner with existing structures, but also new structures like you mentioned, Shannon. The goal is to do that outreach to generate more referrals, get more people to the workforce system, however that entry may be. We, of course, are trying to get folks into the adult programs, which would then allow them to access funding to support themselves at the Community College System of New Hampshire or any other eligible training provider as well. Our first choice is, of course, always the Community College System of New Hampshire. They're a state entity. They're accredited. They have great teachers, great resources, that sort of thing. But of course, as we mentioned earlier, we do have eligible training providers who are private or other nonprofit entities as well. So we see the VIP effort as being complementary to that. And acknowledging too, I mean, we're talking about 1.2 million over, please correct me if I'm wrong, 3 years?
24 months.
24 months, I'm sorry, two years, thank you. So, you know, the goal is to kind of set the foundation and have that continue beyond that. So once the funding expires, that those pipelines and open lines of communication continue. Does that help, Shannon?
Yeah, yeah.
And the last is the statewide workforce assessment. So that was also scored upon the review committee. The finalist was Thomas P. Miller and Associates for returning board members. You might remember those are the folks who helped us with the state plan, which we'll talk about down the line as well with new board members. It's not a fun conversation, but we'll talk about that down the line. But as a workforce system, we've never taken a look under the hood to see how we can do things better. So we wanted to, as a staff and as a board, really take a look at that. Where can we find efficiencies? Where can we streamline? Where can we lean things out? What are we doing great? What are we doing not so great? Again, focused on continuous improvement. So we're going to have, if approved by the board, TPMA, or Thomas P. Miller and Associates, will actually come to a board meeting. I correct me if I'm wrong, Lisa, at the end to report out? Or
We have them scheduled for to at the end and one kind of in the middle to give a progress.
So they'll be coming actually before the board so you can ask questions and whatnot. But again, helping inform decisions of how we can do things better and improve.
Great. Thank you, Joe. Any questions? Any further questions from anybody? If not, I'll entertain a motion on VIP, Southern New Hampshire Services and International Institute of Labor, and the statewide workforce assessment of Thomas P. Miller. So that's all.
Second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, everybody.
But I'm abstaining.
Yes, one abstention. And 3H.
Thank you again for the record, Joe Dorian, the Office of Workforce Opportunity. So, again, I guess a consistent message. Whenever federal government gives us an opportunity for flexibility, we really do try to run with it. So we're looking to move $300,000 from the Dislocated Worker Program to the Adult Program. For those who have been on the board for a number of years, back in, I think it was 2018, somebody predated by joining the office, we actually moved adult funds to Dislocated Worker to reflect the need in the different programs. We, between the VIP effort and a number of other efforts, we're trying to increase enrollments within the adult programs. We're trying to strategically move money around between two different funding streams. Additionally, because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Dislocated Worker, which is run by New Hampshire Employment Security, you had 116,000 claims. And people who were filing for unemployment, we were finding were not really seeking training, so then we had, we ended up with a surplus in these funds. So we're trying to move them to the appropriate area. So in the term, you know, I hope that if the economy, I don't like to use the word that has recess in it, because I'm trying not to say that word. We might, of course, come back to the board for the next program year and we'll be dealt into dislocated. So it's just a natural thing that we try to do, take a look at enrollments, take a look at different efforts and initiatives, and move money around, because, again, the feds give us the ability, and we try to match that wherever possible.
Questions from anybody? Thank you, Joe. No questions? Is there a motion to approve? Second. Thank you, Joe. Motion made, second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Back to back. Board motions and general discussion.
And thank you again, Joe Dorian, for the record. So this is this is an opportunity for new returning board members. This is always an item that you have seen before. For new board members, this will always be an item where it's an opportunity for any motions or just general discussion that you like to have. And we put that at the end too, because that's the last item, so it's up to you on when you like the board meeting to end.
Anything everybody have they'd like to add?
Yes, Justin Cantor. Joe, I just had a quick question. You talked about the State Fire Academy was being approved, or what's that process?
Absolutely. And I wish, Lisa, I think, just excuse yourself for a quick moment. So, again, for the record, Joe Dorian, so I was asked by Commissioner Quinn to join the Recruitment and Retention Committee, Department of Safety. And during that work, we realized the New Hampshire Fire Academy is not one of our eligible training providers. We have great partnerships with the community college system, with the trucking schools across the state. We have a number of providers, but the New Hampshire Fire Academy, which is funded to tax dollars, provided an essential service, was not on there. So we worked with Director Cutting. We actually received their paperwork. I think I mentioned at the board meeting, board training, I think that day or the day prior. So they're going through the process. I have to circle back with Lisa on an exact date. But what that means is that those who are eligible for our program, and we'd like to thank, if I can go back, thank Governor Sununu, and I know Jonathan's from the governor's office. We approached the governor on expanding eligibility for our adult program because we tend to serve more low income and kind of low middle income. And we've actually got the Fed again gave us that flexibility to expand eligibility. So we took that opportunity and did that. And that's good for a whole lot of different programs on the eligible training provider list. And of course, now the Fire Academy will come on that list. So our whole goal of an office is how do we break down barriers, expand access to good quality employment and jobs. And of course, the fire service being when I come from a firefighter family. And so the paperwork has gone through. Question on the Fire Academy paperwork, where is that in the process? Do you have an update with us? Can you mention that?
So, Lisa Gerard, Office of Workforce Opportunity. They have submitted the paperwork for the eligible training provider list. They now have to add programs to our what we call InSight, which is the actual system, so that everyone can see them. They'll go through an approval process, and then they will be eligible to be a training provider and have the programs on. So we're very close.
And we're happy to work with any eligible training provider. If folks around the room have a program that they would like to see training, whether it be new or old or whatever, we're happy to do that. We've added, through that work for Recruitment and Retention Committee, we've added two EMT programs, which is incredibly helpful because that's an in-demand occupation as well. We've had conversations with the Police Academy as well. Thankfully, the firefighters have really kind of taken and run with it. So, cops are kind of, they got to play catch up. But what's going to be great is new firefighters are going to be able to access $6,500 in training dollars. Now $1,500 in supportive services, so that's boots, books, mileage, child care.
Testing fees, physical exam fees, those are things that can also be paid under support services.
And 5,500 on-job training, and we think that this could have potentially some really positive property tax implications as well for towns and cities to help defray some costs, but also further incentivize young people to find fire careers here in New Hampshire and not look to other states and the region. So, did I help answer your question?
No, for sure. I know working here in Concord, not the boardroom, this quick information, a lot of feedback that we get in Concord specifically, which is very common for the career departments that don't have volunteers, is there's no avenue that you can affiliate yourselves with us unless you're employed with us. So what makes that difficult is when you go to take your fire class at the state fire academies, for example, Firefighter 1, which is the first level of the certification, there's two different price points to take that class. One is the affiliated cost, which is just basically means I am joining a fire department, and that's like a $200 fee to take that class. If you're not affiliated, it's over $2,000. And so if you live in a city or any town that has a career department that doesn't have a way that you can affiliate yourselves, well, you're stuck paying that full tuition cost versus if you live in a community that luckily had a volunteer department, you can say, hey, I'm Joe Schmoll, I'd like to join the fire department, and you save a significant cost savings. So to try and create kind of these areas that we can say, here's an opportunity to go become and join in this career that is also affordable versus taking that big hit. And I'm glad that we're heading in this direction.
And I guess I probably shouldn't say this, but I'd really love to come to the board and say that we've done such a good job of getting out the community, outreach, and that all adult money has been expended. That'd be honestly a great problem to have when we can go back to the feds, because that means we're getting workers trained and upskilled. Again, with the help of the governor's office, expanding eligibility, expanding opportunity and choice as well. We're meeting with anybody. What outreach is made in religious groups, different ethnic communities across the state, different industries that's because the fire service that never had an issue recruiting before. Same thing with police. They've never in the history, you know, as we're talking, you've had five slots, they have 20 applicants. We're trying to expand to meet the demands of employers of all shapes, sizes, public, private, that sort of thing. We're having conversations with municipalities as well about different training opportunities there, because everyone is hurting for one.
Thank you.
Anything else, anybody? Before we close, I just want to introduce Sarah Morrison, who she's our employment services director. There's so many new faces here, I just wanted to make sure I introduced her before we close. And she's very active out there. She's getting out in the community. We're doing the virtual job here, so we're all the same. And her team does a great job attracting the folks, getting back into the workforce. So, among other things, and our offices are fully open now. We're open 4 hours a day. They're fully open now. We should have the office off the same. So, with that, for the record, again, Georgia Battis, Commissioner for Public Security. I'd like to thank all the members for attending today, all the new members that attended today, the presenters that came to make their presentations. It was very powerful presentations, and this meeting was compliant with RSA 91-A, so this meeting was recorded. I also want to just give one last round of applause to Dave for 18 years. Did you ever miss a meeting?
I don't know.
That's an honest answer.
Depending on whether it's a golf schedule.
Well, again, thank you everybody for attending today. And we'll see you in the next meeting. And thank you for everything you've offered at the meeting today. A lot of good information. Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to talk to you.